Actor and musician Ian Roberts is something of a South African icon, renowned for his roles as the rugged Boer fighter Sloot Steenkamp in the TV series Arendt and as Boet in the immortal and immensely popular Castrol advertisements. His book, Nomad Heart, offers a highly entertaining glimpse of how actors make the magic happen, whether on a theatre stage or before the TV cameras. In this episode of PageCast, Ian is in conversation with Deputy News Editor at Bild, Joe Prince. Enjoy.
Today we have the pleasure of the company of Ian Roberts, memoir Nomad Heart, Adventures on and Off the Set, is a topic. Fantastic read. I really enjoyed it. I read it in a sitting or two last week. I couldn't stop. It's translated into Is Dit Jy, the Afrikaans version. And yeah, that's why we have you here today, Ian.
Yeah, lovely to be here, man. Thank you.
Tell me, before we start jumping into the book, were you approached? How did it come about that you actually wrote this?
Yeah, I've been writing since I was about 10 years old. I wrote my first play at St. Andrew's Prep School, together with my cousin Dan. And so in the army, I wrote a play on my telex machine when I was in the signalers, you know, on maneuver. So I've always been writing, but I've never thought of ever publishing a sort of like a memoir. But I met this Russian actor on a movie, Auf Asche, German movie, at Manfred Krug. And he said, "You South Africans, you're always doing jock, 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 jock. It's not very funny." So I said, "Okay, so what do you do there in Russia?" He said, "We do anecdote." And he told me a very funny anecdote. So I called all these little things. When COVID hit, I started writing these things down, and I called them all anecdote.
Right.
And then Nico Moorman, the man who wrote the Boer Hall, he was connected with Jonathan Ball. I mean, I'm a complete stranger when it comes to this publishing. And he said, "Well, you can phone Annie, you know." And I phoned her, and she said, "Nah, not interested in this stuff. Thanks. The form is not right."
Okay.
But on the back of this email, there's a little page there that says what we like to see. So she said, "Don't bother if you never get back to us, because very few people do. Very few people do." So I got back to them with another rewritten 75 pages. They said they wanted to publish, and that began a process, really, from there. So the editing process was a foreign beast to me.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it. You know, and yeah, we sit.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, that's a fantastic read. Annie told me a story, that you initially wrote something and it was stolen out of your combi or your
Land Rover. When doing The Wild, that TV series of Mnet,
yes,
we used to go to Heidelberg to a game farm every morning, all us actors, sitting in a combi. I mean, they were all Toyotas, but I got bored after about, you know, a month of that. And then I took my computer every day, put headphones on. The actors would say, good morning, blah, blah, blah. And then all fall asleep or whatever, and I'd write. Lots. And remember, I had no idea of editing or whatever. But then I went to Delta Park with my 19 Futsak VW combi camper, okay. And they stole the combi plus the computer and everything gone. I just wished it well.
Mm.
Then COVID happened, and I actually was a good boy. Stayed inside.
Mm.
And there started writing.
Yeah. You had lots of time to get back into it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the product of that was 500 pages in 3 weeks.
Sure.
And then edited down to also selected. There's many, many sections of those anecdotes. Yeah. It's not near this book. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that is a recurring theme in the book, and something which I identify quite a bit with, is the energy you get out of being in nature. When you're on set preparing for a specific role, or when something big is happening in your life, you get out of the rut and you go in either hiking, climbing, ocean. Tell me about that energy. What do you get out of that, and what do you take back to the stage?
It's a truly fascinating question, that because I think that the world is becoming more and more, as technology takes over more and disarms us on survival tactics. Mm. And, you know, you can't fix your car unless you plug it into a computer, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. You need an app or something.
Yeah. It takes us more and more away from nature.
Mm.
And, you know, nature gets out of tune very quickly with you. You start to look at like a baboon and you think that's what it is. But when you see it, okay, we had a baboon on a movie called Kalahari Harry.
Mm.
And I had to make friends with the baboon. It was a female baboon.
Yeah.
And it had come in a trailer from Palabora to their Tweede field in the thing. So the woman, a German woman who ran this baboon sanctuary, she said, okay, we are friends with this baboon, you know. And in the cage, the baboon was sitting there. It's not a big baboon, like a female.
Yeah.
She said, I will go in, I will make the baboon comfortable and calm, and then you come in and you sit there, and then I will introduce you to the baboon for the alpha male, yeah? And I went in, and this baboon took one look at me and just went for me.
Well.
The speed of that baboon. I got its jaws around my calf, and then it froze. It didn't bite me.
Mm.
Put a tooth through my jeans and into my leg, just one of the teeth. And I lifted my fist like as to beat it off. And she said, don't move.
Mm.
And now the speed of that baboon is the part of nature that we forget.
Mm.
That creature, and then you can just extrapolate that to everything. All the birds, all the everything. They have to survive. Now that energy, it comes to you because you are now part of it.
Sure.
If you walk. Mm. Nature has saved me. I say it straight.
Mm.
Yeah, from bad situations, I've gone there and found peace.
Like it's something that you can sense that in the book.
That
nature plays a big role in your sanity.
So
I wanted to ask you about the whole. My grandparents are from Adelaide.
Eastern Cape.
In the Eastern Cape.
Yeah, yeah.
So starting reading where you are from, and where you grew up.
Yeah.
And the whole hunter-gatherer chummies of yours, how did it, you tell that it comes out in the telling of the hunter-gatherers? But when did your taste for acting start?
I don't know. It's a weird thing, you know. St. Andrew's Prep had big productions.
Okay.
That also had a stage that you could go onto where I wrote the first play at the age of 10. Then St. Andrew's College had inter-house theatrical competitions.
Right.
So, you know, there were only boys there, so some folks had to play girls and women and all that. And we won the competition one year with a Welsh play.
Mm.
And it became very popular, and we eventually had to go and perform it for the town council down in the city hall.
Mm.
So, and then I went to the army. An army,
man,
it's just, you forget about all that stuff.
Mm.
And then I decided, army 18, work 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. When I was 24, I decided to go for an audition in PE at the Amateur Dramatics.
Okay.
They were putting up What the Butler Saw by Joe Orton. I went to audition, and the guy gave me the leading role.
Nice.
Then the production fell through.
Oh,
but I had bitten it again.
Yeah.
And I never forget standing on the street in PE. I was running a clothing store, very expensive clothes for Africans, like, you know, Nunbush shoes and stuff from America.
Yeah.
Expensive. Leaning on a dustbin one Monday morning with Shorty, the hunchback salesman, Tosa. And he said to me, what are you reading in this newspaper? I said, no, man, they've got auditions, you know. And he said, oh, what is that? And eventually, and then I decided, I'm going to go. And then when the production fell through, I went to my father and I said, I want to go to university. I want to be an actor.
Okay.
And he, as a citrus farmer, said, that's very interesting,
nice.
My boy.
Nice.
But I'll back you.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
You're also right about that, obviously, the whole idea of going straight from school to university or acting or whatever you think you want to do, but living a bit, doing other things.
Yeah.
And that time isn't a waste of time. You need to live a bit, to have your own story, then go to university and then you get more. Tell me about that, the whole other lives you have to live before you do what you think you should be doing.
Yeah, I... You know, listen, when I did all those things, I never thought I was going to be an actor.
Mm.
But only in retrospect, then I realized when I was at university with these young kids, they were 17, 18 years old.
So you were 24.
I was 24. First year, yeah. And they had no experience, man. Mm. They had nothing. They just came from good homes where mommy and daddy sent them to university because that's what you did. Mm. Luckily, I went to the army, and the army was an extension of boarding school. That's all.
Yeah.
And luckily, I didn't have to go and shoot people and get shot at. So it was just luck. Mm. But that
you
army.
You were signals.
Yeah. The army experience, then you go out, then my father and I farmed together on his big farm. I worked for him for a year. Then I did door-to-door salesman. I did LTA construction. I did fiberglass products, factory manager. These things teach you about survival in the world. Now, if you're an actor and you're 18 and you're going to go and learn to be an actor, all you really know is school. Mm. So you can act about school. You can act a teacher very well. But that's it. Mm. So I always say to kids who come to me and say, hey, I want to be an actor, and say, go get a job.
Yeah.
Work.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. You also write about the whole process of auditioning. That was quite interesting to me. I know very little of. I've never been in an audition.
Oh, really?
So, the idea of the energy you have to bring to that audition and how technology changed that. Tell me about that a bit.
Yeah. Well, look, now after Corona, now the world has become so platitudinous. Mm. You audition on a cell phone.
Yeah, that's weird.
I mean, you know, what can you get? What can I get out of you from a cell phone picture of you?
Yeah, yeah.
Now that I'm sitting here with you, I can feel you. I know what you're about, and maybe you can act that role. Mm. A great story, which is actually in the book, is that Welsh Selen Jones or whatever who came to do coup, the Ivory Coast coup, and I was playing. I was auditioning for the Afrikaans Nick du Toit.
Yes.
And I didn't get the part. And 2 weeks later, the woman who was in those auditions, she came back to South Africa. And she said, she phoned my agent. I had to meet her. We drank coffee. She said, I've been watching your auditions. And you know what? I think you're being very deceptive. I said,
yeah.
Yeah. She said, I know that you're hiding stuff because you don't want to give Nick du Toit now. I said, that's exactly the truth. She said, I will persuade Mr. Selen Jones to use you, and I played the role. Mm. So she smelt it out. Now, auditions, if you imagine now you audition and you work yourself out, you really want this part, and one of the key scenes you play utterly.
Yeah.
That can be gone from that moment.
On the day you have to deliver it.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
And I've seen this. You know, when I've directed, an actor in an audition gives a certain thing, and then you get on the scene that, you know, 3 weeks later, it's nowhere.
Yeah.
So auditions can be destructive. Mm. And I mean, a cell phone. Mm. I actually laughed. The other day I did an audition. I said, I don't want to do this audition. Goodbye.
Okay.
Yeah. So I love the old days, the class of the old days, where a director would come to the theater.
Nice.
And would watch you. Mm. And after that play, would come and offer you the role.
Get a sense of what you're about and then go.
Yeah, and he had the balls to say, I don't care, to the producers. This is the guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You also write about the whole, when you've done an opening night, the next day, you must be left alone. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you don't ever fiddle with an actor on the day after opening night. No.
I didn't know that.
Okay, no matter how wrong he was, you leave him because he's been through hell.
Yes.
Through rehearsals to get to that opening night, which is always a complete trial. Mm. And then you come there and say, excuse me, you need to rehearse. Mm. Oh, no. That's not politics in movies, in theater. Mm. You don't do that. And it was done to me.
Yeah.
And I let the person know.
So you write about your strong right fist, the uppercut you can give. tell us a story about when you approached Rian Milan.
Yeah. Now, my cousin actually was very funny with that thing because Rian and Dan were a very, very good writing team.
Yeah.
And after that altercation between me and Rian, he went back to Joburg and he went to Dan and he said, your cousin threatened me with physical violence. And Dan said, yes, so what did you say? He said, nothing. Mm. And he said, well, what do you think about that? That's not acceptable. And Dan said, well, if he threatened you with physical violence, there's a very good reason.
Mm.
And I'd be careful. And then as Rion was walking out the door, Dan said, and remember, he was captain of boxing.
One of the chapters you write about being an honorary Afrikaner, and the apart from the Castrol ads that ran so long, but with Sluitsteenkamp, people resonate with you, especially Afrikaans speaking people, and jy is Engels spreekend. So the whole you're very pro Afrikaner for an English chap. Tell me a bit about that. The whole,
I think it comes from learning history. I've always been curious about people and what they do in their lives, and how they react to situations, you know. And I think from an acting point of view also, you need to know about this. And when I had to do Sluitsteenkamp, for the first time, I really studied the Boer background. And I found them more and more my imagination's beauty. I loved what they did. Okay, then no one's perfect. No nation is perfect. But I love a picture of Louis Botha and his officier in the Eastern Transvaal having a bosberaad, you know, a meeting of war.
Yeah.
And they're sitting on the ground, man. You know, if you go to an English army camp, then chairs. Polish your shoes, you know, all that rubbish. And I'm not like that. I'm more Boer,
I remember Dominique Botha when she wrote her first novel. It's called Falrivier. I might have the title wrong now, but she also did the translation herself from the Afrikaans to the English, and she said the Afrikaans was like, the English was like working on a Casio, but the Afrikaans was like a Steinway. And I get that feel when I look at these two books. Also the close up in the Afrikaans one of you on the cover, it looks a lot more personal, and the English is at a distance, and it's also sort of a feel for the languages in the two books.
You know, my mother used to always say to me, she was Irish and my family was completely English, they never spoke Afrikaans, but my mother used to always say to me, you know, my boy, look at these Afrikaans people. Because our foreman was Afrikaans. And his wife, Joyce, was like such a chick. Look how they hug each other. We don't do that. You know? And she said, I envy that. You know, my mommy said she wanted to be like that. I'm thinking it's her Irish blood coming out. Because they are more like huggy, you know. But from early on I've known. And at school, St. Andrew's College, we used to always rip off the Afrikaans teacher, the poor man, Ari Blackhear, because he was a rock spider and a cross athlete and all that bull dust, you know. But then his teaching obviously got through to us, because here we are now, and I like the whole notion of Boer, you know.
The whole idea of intimacy, right at the end of your book, you write that how your parents phoned you and wanted you to come back home because they had something urgent to tell me about that.
You know, I've always known that the third child in a family is always the one that can break out, you know, because the oldest gets disciplined, the second one a little bit less, but then the third one is the SWAT, you know. And this was like my parents saying to me, they want to apologize for not bringing me up properly. And then they managed to get to the word, we didn't give you enough love.
Yeah.
You know? I just looked at them and I thought, crikey, if you only knew what a blessing you were to me.
Sweet.
By ignoring me.
Yeah.
Thank heavens.
Yeah.
Because that's what I wanted.
I want to come back to the hunter-gatherers you write about in the beginning. The tribe, those three friends of yours, and also the idea of we spoke about language now, Afrikaans and English, but Xhosa, the effect of that on how you see the world around you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, if you say in English, there goes the buck, there's the duiker, there's running along like that. You know.
Yeah.
Afrikaans sê, daar gaat hy, daar gaat hy, die ding is vinnig, whatever. Mm. En Kosa sê, it's completely different world.
Yes.
And way of seeing it.
Mm.
So if you're going to act that, I realized early on, you got to become Kosa.
Yeah.
To act Kosa.
Mm.
So you mustn't be white anymore.
Mm.
Your concept of what you are is to change.
Yeah, yeah.
And helped me immensely in playing different Afrikaans characters that also spoke Xhosa or Zulu or whatever, and English. And again, to go from Afrikaans to English, is there a change?
Mm.
You know,
mm.
It's like, I don't really agree with you.
Yeah.
Extending with somebody.
Mm.
You know, it's just different.
Yeah.
And Xhosa was for me, I really believe that people should speak more than one language.
Yes, totally.
Full stop.
Especially in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one more,
mm.
you know.
Mm.
And in the Radio Kalahari Orchestra, when we have a performance, then we always do one English song for the monolinguists.
Ah, goed.
For the English. And then you always get some English people come and say, can't you do more of that stuff?
Okay. Okay. The Radio Kalahari Orchestra, how did that start?
We always played music, obviously, from 9 years old. I was making money out of music. Then I forgot about it, and I got an attitude to say, you cannot make money out of music because you spoil it.
Mm.
You know, if you have to play for someone, and then, of course, all this has changed because...
I wanted to ask you, you're okay with getting money now?
Oh, yeah. and even further than that, I really like performing music now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's changed even further than I thought. But it started because... I always forget this guy's name, man, Dibura Yuat, the guy who ran EMI. He's just stepped down now as the boss of EMI.
Okay.
But he was he's a character.
Mm.
He heard Dan's song, The Crying Shame.
Okay.
He said, can you make a video of this song? Because I really like it. And Dan put it all together. He's a great organizer. Got to his house. We'd just been fired by Castro. Norman Anstey, me, and Fats Buchholan.
How long that ad ran?
17 years.
17 years. That's amazing.
Nice. And it did well.
Yes. Yeah.
So Dan said, being an organizer of note, he said, why don't you guys just front the song? Because we've got no singers, you know. So we said, yeah, good idea.
Yeah.
And we came on his stoop and we suddenly were singers in a band, you know, of this band,
yes.
which we didn't have a name for.
Mm.
Then Dibura Yurt liked that so much, he commissioned a CD. And there it started. Yeah. Norman just has a good voice.
Yeah.
I had to learn how to sing. Fats used to just flick a fly whisk as a chief. And every now and go and say, yes.
It's a nice bass.
Yes. So that's how we started as the front end of the Radio Kalahari.
Yeah. On the set, when you started out with Castrol ads, I mean, that took a whole narrative. You'd have a starting, like a little skit going, and then... Tell me about the follow-up seasons of that.
Look, they obviously Castrol's thing is changing all the time, so we had to change with it, you know. And every time a new product came out, then we'd have to do something else. So in advertising, you know, you get writers and they write the ideas, and the ideas get presented, and then Castrol will say, yeah, we want to make that one.
Mm.
And that's how we just moved with it. I think in all the years that we worked with them, we only threw one story out.
Oh, okay.
And that is when a farmer, who would have been me, my boot character, got stuck in the sand.
Yeah.
I said, they never do. Kalahari farmers.
No.
Forget it. So they threw that out. But all the other stories went right through. And there's some very clever stories, you know. The only thing that really changed on Castrol was the, you know, the glory years of South Africa. In arts, the 80s, the late 80s, early 90s, there was such a structure of class, of people on trajectories, you know, going big, that we were just part of that. We went out to the Kalahari, to Puputatswana, and we shot other side Otterzell in it with a big tented camp in the Kalahari.
Sure.
You know, so you feel special.
Mm, totally. You know. All production, yeah.
And then they shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and the last ads we made in a studio in Joburg.
Sure.
With a green screen.
Yeah. When people approach you, do they recognize you as Boet, or do they recognize you as Slut, or what's
depends
the
depends where?
Yeah.
Often the Kestrel guys, in English areas, but in Afrikaans areas it's Slut.
Is that?
Yeah. That's who it is. And some people even call me that. I don't have a name, I'm called Slut. Slut, call me so. I like, I was in America once with an actor, Sam Jones, who played Flash Gordon, and we'd done a movie together in Mauritius. Mm. And I ended up there doing the cameraman audition.
Mm.
And Sam and I went into this place in Los Angeles, and it was like all these made-up waitresses, who are actors in their home state, but now they're trying to make it in L.A.
Yeah.
And for a South African, it's like, what? What a culture shock. Anyway, we cut a few Coronas, of course, and then someone recognized Sam. Do you know that we had to actually run out of that restaurant? He was getting mobbed.
No.
Yes, Flash Gordon, man. Yeah. And South Africa is not like that.
Mm.
Much more relaxing.
Yes.
And people actually apologize sometimes when they come and say, listen, I don't want to disturb you. Mm. I know people, can we do a photo? Mm. And it's so genteel.
Mm.
By comparison, I like that.
The whole cameraman thing that you turned it down in the end.
Yeah.
In retrospect, you think that was the right sort of decision?
Well, the government turned it down for me.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Because of apartheid, I couldn't get a visa. Right.
Yeah.
For Borneo.
Okay.
Which now is a highly dubious country, but anyway, then that's where the waterfalls were, where they wanted to shoot these guys. Right.
But you had to help sit on that. You wanted to do that, or what?
No, I had a problem with it. I had this idea, because I smoked a hell of a lot. So I was used to think, I'm going to persuade people to do this.
Yes.
That's going to be your legacy.
Yeah.
And then I had serious problems, and I was on the trimpel, as they say, to go to my agent, Moonin Lee, and say, listen, I can't do this. Because she had the first quotes, and she was quoting, big money.
Yeah.
But then the government saved me.
Right.
Yeah.
Made a decision for you.
Yeah, I can't get a visa. And the American company shut it down.
Yeah. What was your most difficult role?
Yeah, there have been quite a few that I shouldn't have tried to act. Because, you're an actor, you've got young children, you've got to make money, so you just do the role and shut up,
Yeah.
But if I go back... Look, they're all – the most difficult is when I've had to do sex scenes.
Okay.
And I look at them in a script and I think, who's this chick going to be, And the one was with Chloe Sevigny.
Right.
She was like a great American actress down in Port St. John's, and the director was a big guy, a gay guy, Tom, from Halifax, and he had this big beard, So what I had to do – I played like a sugar magnet, an oak with lots of money. And the nurse comes to get money for the AIDS patients, blah, blah, blah. And I throw her on this table, rip her top open, rip her bra off, and have sort of sex with her.
Mm.
And I thought, I can't do this.
Mm.
Yes, Chloe, I've got to do all this with her. Throw on a table. And I was walking to the director, Tom, who had set up the whole scene, and he was walking to where the camera was, and obviously everyone's banned from the scene. There's only a sound man and a cameraman. I was going to tell him, listen here, get another actor. I can't do this, because it was early in the movie. And something on my walk there said to me, hey, man, don't be chicken. Play the first part of the scene. If you can do that, maybe you can think of the rest.
Okay.
But if you can't do the first part, you can't run away, So I turned around. And I did the rehearsal with Chloe and ripped everything and did everything right. And then I said, are you okay? She said, no, I'm fine, Ian. Just be careful with my left boob because I had a bit of work done there. And that just charmed me. So I always found them difficult. That's like a really private part of your life, and it's being kind of thrown out there.
And with a sound man and a cameraman looking on and whatever.
Weird, man. But in terms of difficult roles, there's many that I've struggled with. And I quite honestly don't really think they're very good, the acting.
Okay.
And one of the times where I made mistakes that I clearly saw in the movie was when in the movie Kalahari Harry, when I was in a bar and I played this thing, but I played it like a complete moron. But it was accepted and stuck in the movie. And then I thought, no, man, someone should have said to me, stop this.
Yeah.
What are you doing? And actors are vulnerable. Sure. They cannot see themselves. And they depend entirely on the eye of the director.
Yeah, you're too close to it.
Marnie van Rensburg used to always say, he used to never direct actors, by the way. He wouldn't say, excuse me, turn this way or do it. He would leave that all to you. And if you didn't pull it off, you might get three takes. And then you get fired.
What do you prefer, being directed in a sense, or just being left?
Left completely alone.
What's that?
Look, if you run into a head-on collision, you cannot play the part. It happens, you know, on a day that you're just useless, you know. Then you want a director who says to you, okay, I've worked this out. You come out the door there, you hit the guy here, you walk around, you kiss the girl there, and that's, I've got the camera. That helps you, you know.
Yeah.
But generally, I don't like a director to be concerned. He should know that actors are responsible for acting.
Sure.
Like the German director, Dieter Reibler, he's now passed on, but he came to South Africa and he did a lot of work. And we were doing The Emperor and the Architect of Assyria, Arabal's play, completely crazy play, where I had to eat a man's leg, you know. After 2 weeks rehearsal, he said, okay, guys, me and Roger Dwyer, he said, let's do a run through of this play and let's just see how we are progressing. Yeah. So we did a run through. It was appalling. So after the run through, he said, yes, I have watched this now, but I am not impressed with your work. Now he's the director. Yeah. And we South Africans say, hey man, you should direct us, you know.
Yes.
He said, you know, you actors have not really applied yourselves to these rehearsals. Mm. And I am now going to ask you to go home. Go home now and study your character and build your character, and then you can come back tomorrow. Now that sophistication is what actors need to run into. And I was lucky to run into that early.
Nice.
And you go. Mm. You go home and you work.
You have a chapter that you dedicate to Marnie van Rensburg. Tell me about that.
No, I was a big influence in my acting, movie directing, because I've directed quite a lot, television, and I made my own movie also. He was the first man that I ever ran into who had a really powerful persona.
Yeah.
You know, like you know your father, you know your uncle, you know other men, great for me, great men, and then you run into this force. When you talk to that guy, you knew that you were talking to a very intense intellect, and you didn't waste your words on purpose. And he developed this technique that I found so funny. If you know actors on set, they're often very, hey, you know, it's so good to be here, man, making a movie, you know. And they get the director and they say, yo, how's it going? And he would sit there with his coffee and talk with him for a while, then he just turned on and walk away. And then the actor would say, hey, where's he going, man? I'm still talking with him. I was in Nabru. He's gone. Leave him. He's thinking about his movie.
Yes.
And I always called him, at developed time, I called him a pirate of the high seas.
Mm.
And his ship was called Movie. So if you challenge his ship, you better have a good challenge.
Yeah.
You know.
And you have the dictum, like, the movie comes first.
The movie comes first, yeah. Come all, nice. Cut all your rubbish out when you come to set.
Mm.
And his sets were always, as a result, very quiet.
Mm.
So actors could work with each other.
Yes.
Because we will always work. Give us a chance, give us a scene, we will work. Don't have to have a director, because we're getting it better, you know.
Yeah.
And then he will come and say, okay, here's a shot, you're going to do this, you're going to do this. Action, boom, you know. Quiet, silence. It's changed. It's not like that anymore.
Could you read the poem you wrote on Marnie's death?
Yeah. Remember, the setting of this was, I'd just been to the house and I'd run into those cops, and I was now in a very cold, smoky hillbrow to shoot some scenes there.
Right.
And then I looked up and I wrote this on Marnie's death. The smoke down here and the clouds up there are blowing much the same. But the smoke down here's direction is changing, swinging, shifting. And up there, the gradual cloud still moving in the direction of the weather vane. While we, the left behind, are just the uncertain, timid vacillations of our buffered mankind. The smog down here is grey, heavy with smudge. Up there, cumulonimbus castles, vast and crystal white, reflecting another helderder, untainted light.
Sure. Mm. Oh, beautiful.
That's it.
When are you doing a collection of poetry?
I've actually got another poem I wrote called Betrayal, which is quite... the guys like it. I read it, you know, to the orchestra to try and educate them.
Yeah.
And poetry for me, I've written poetry my whole life, and they're all flapping around on tent pegs and old pieces of barbed wire in the wind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and thank you very much. I think your book is a fantastic read. Like I said, I must actually now go sit and read the Afrikaans.
Yeah, the Afrikaans has got power. Eh?
Yeah. But thank you very much for your time. And I think, I hope it's like your poems that are flapping around. I hope this flaps all around the country.
Oh, thank you. That is so kind of you. Yeah.
Very cool.
Mission is grand, as they say.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Brook.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.